Welcome to, or welcome back. It is the Level One Coach Podcast. We are in season two after a what felt like forever hiatus, but we're back. We're still here. We're still doing it. Drew Carlson and Mikhail Bryan, who you'll hear from in a second. We essentially started this podcast for people that are maybe just joining in. A handful of them have been on this infinite game concept. Something that we both kind of strongly believe in and enjoy talking about. And the thing about like the infinite game is once you start seeing it somewhere, you start seeing it everywhere, and it kind of becomes something that you can always notice, name, and then like have a conversation about. So we're going to talk about We read the first book by Sinek because it was made popular kind of in our generation. And I was advised by one of my buddies to go back to the source and read the original by James Carse, and told Mikhail, like, hey, maybe you want to read it too. He's about halfway through it. And we got to a point where I saw this quote, and I'm going to kick it over to you and we'll start talking. But the quote from the book is, finite players play within boundaries, infinite play with boundaries.
So what comes to mind for me, well, first of all, good to be back after what did feel like a long hiatus. What comes to mind for me in the like player development world, if you want to call it that, or like with players, and there's obviously an application to coaches too, and we'll get into that in a minute. But with players, like, so I guess I think for me, like, the easiest way to describe what's coming to mind for me would be like within the NHL. Like, if you are playing within the boundaries, then the only players, if you're drafting or you're calling up at any point, or I guess not calling up because those would be players under contract, but drafting or signing free agents, the only players you're going to look at are guys that have either, you know, say you're drafting, you're only going to look at major junior, maybe some NCAA, maybe you look Europe, but probably not quite as much because there's not as great of a history depending on what league or what team you're looking at. It's not like Europe is just one big league. Like, there's so many different levels to it, juniors, pro, different countries. So you're going to look at, you know, the OHL and the WHL and the Q have produced prospects. You know, the NCAA recently has. So you're going to look, that's your boundary. You're just going to look at what's safe, and you know that's safe. You're looking to sign free agents, and same thing. You're looking for guys that have played in the NHL. If they haven't played in the NHL, maybe they've played in the American League for a while. Maybe they're coming out of a CHL, so one of those Canadian leagues, or NCAA. But again, like, you're maybe a little bit more weary of, well, he played in the KHL, but that's an Olympic sheet. It's in Russia. We don't know much about it. You're more weary of that. And within the player development or player progression world, like, that's safe because you're in the boundary of what's proven success in the past. If you are playing with the boundaries, then you're looking at this and you're thinking, okay, well, we could go to where everyone else goes, and we could just focus on the CHL and the NCAA, or we could try to think outside the box here. And what are maybe some other levels that we could draft players from? Maybe we look at, and this is all becoming more common now, and obviously last night was the first round, and there were plenty of USHL players drafted, mainly from NTDP in that first round. But like, now you're looking at drafting maybe players from the USHL, maybe from prep or U18 levels that, yeah, they're not playing in the OHL, but their ceiling is still really high. Or you're looking at Europe. And again, there were more players drafted, I think, in that first round last night. At one point, there were like 8 or 9, European players already, and it wasn't all the way through. So this is becoming more common to play with these boundaries, at least within the draft. But now when you're talking free agents, like, I can think of, I think it's Derek Ryan that the Hurricanes signed a few years ago. And he was 29 years old and had been playing, I think, in Germany, but for sure in Europe for the last couple of years. And Pierre-Edouard Belmar is another guy, French. And he was playing, I think, in Sweden and then maybe Switzerland before. Was it the Flyers that first signed him? I think it was the Flyers. But those are like, that's outside of the box. That's not a normal free agent signing, guys that are 28, 29 years old. And even if you rewind like 20 years ago, no one was drafting, or not as many European players were being drafted that highly or straight out of Europe. And so I think those are examples of like within players, like you're playing with that boundary. Now you're not limiting yourself to just the guys that have come from established leagues. And I'll kick it back to you after I give you a quote here. And you will have read this for sure, because it's from Sam Hinkie's letter of resignation.
Oh, buddy.
But which you did send me. But I think it applies to this pretty well. So at one point in his letter of resignation, I'll just read the quote. He says, "The same 82 games are up for grabs every year for every team, just like in 1985 or before. To get more wins, you're going to have to take them from someone else. Wins are a zero growth industry. And how many of you regularly choose to invest in those? The only way up is to steal share from your competitors. You will have to do something different. You will have to be contrarian. Howard Marks describes this as a necessary condition of great performance. You have to be non-consensus and right, both. That means you have to find some way to have a differentiated viewpoint from the masses, and it needs to be right. Anything less won't work." So before I throw it back to you, like, the reason I bring that up is because playing with the boundaries requires you to be contrarian and right, just like Hinkie says. Because if you're contrarian and wrong, it's not going to work. Or you're right, but not contrarian, not playing with the boundaries, then you're trying to steal the same OHL players from somebody else. And if that year you select 16th instead of 6th, you just don't get them. So you can now just go to the OHL and be like, well, we'll just take anyone now because we know it's a good league. Or you could be like, we have the 16th overall pick. Is there a guy out there who's really good that we can take from a different league who might provide that same upside as the 6th overall pick? He's just not playing in the OHL, so no one's on him as high, or guys aren't as high on him as others. And when you look down the history of the Nikita Kucherovs and Braden Points and those are just two names that come to mind, but they weren't first rounders, weren't 5th overall picks, but they turned out to be rock star NHLers. That's somebody playing with the boundaries. I don't know who it was, but it's somebody playing with the boundaries and going, where can we find the best value for what we currently have? And let's go after that guy instead of going back to the well and taking a surefire OHL star, but who knows if he's going to translate to our level with the NHL.
Yeah, I love that quote and what I wrote down and kind of the connection. Before you mentioned even the contrarian and right by Hinkie, as you were talking, and something we hadn't spoken about off air, just for context, I grew up in, for obviously you know this, but for our listeners, I grew up in Metro Detroit during, I mean, the Red Wings' absolute heyday, back-to-back Cubs twice, and the Russian Five era. And the Russian Five is what I wrote down. And the people in the Wings organization where they're trying to, again, there's, like Hinkie says, there's 82 games up for grabs. There's the same pool of players within that normal boundary. Where can you go to be contrarian and right? And like Daryl Belfry talks about, contrarian and right is essentially, and I use it a lot, different and better. You can't just be different. It has to be better. So how could the Red Wings and their staff take a team that was struggling, be contrarian and right, or different and better? And they went over and legitimately defected players out of Russia or the Soviet Union at the time. So like no one was doing that. No one was thinking to do that. I mean, there were, if anyone's seen like the documentary they did on it, like, I mean, pretty high stakes when you're dealing with that country at that time, with the relations or lack of relations that we have had and still don't really have with them. So, like, that is, we're going outside, like, that's as outside the box as you can go at that time, and, like, way ahead of their time doing it in, you know, the 90s, when we're still, I don't consider our industry to be outside the box by any means. We're starting to get little pockets of it, but doing it 30 years ago was, I mean, way ahead of the curve. So the Russian Five is kind of what came to mind for me there. If you have any thoughts, I'll kick it back over to you.
I mean, that's a perfect example of, like, being outside the box and doing something that a lot of other teams at that time weren't willing to do, whether it was because of, like you said, the need to defect and all that stuff, or just because, hey, they play on an Olympic sheet, they play a possession game, we're different, and you're nervous to take a chance on those guys because what if it doesn't work out? And it's like, yeah, okay, what if it doesn't work out? That's true. What if it does? You end up with back-to-back cups and legitimately one of the best dynasties the NHL has ever seen and likely ever will see. And I kind of extend, I know the Russian Five weren't there in 08, 09 or 09, 10. I forget which year it was that the Red Wings won again, but then you had Datsyuk and Zetterberg, and Lidstrom might've been around still. No, maybe not. I can't remember. But you had those two guys, Datsyuk, Zetterberg, Cronwall, like Holmstrom. You had a really good group of, I may be wrong on Holmstrom too, now that I think about that, but you had a lot of star European players that if you didn't get the original Larionovs and Fetisovs and Konstantinovs, who knows if you get those guys the next time around, you know, 10 to 15 years later. Like, maybe you don't, because maybe they all would have gone to St. Louis, and now Zetterberg and Datsyuk all head to St. Louis too. And it's more complicated than just them deciding to head there, but you get the gist of what I'm saying. Sure. So no, that's an excellent example. And I guess I'm just, as we're talking this through, I wanted to fact check myself and just make sure I'm not a complete idiot. And on last night in the first round of the NHL, 32 selections, 14 were European, and 13 of those 14 were playing in Europe, whether it's juniors or pro. So maybe it's just the scouting departments, which obviously influence the general managers and owners and whatnot, but we're getting better at least at prospect identification of thinking outside the box and playing with some of those boundaries. And not, like, I personally love it. Like, I love to see not a ton of OHL and like the tip. I mean, I'd have to look back, but go back to like the 02 draft or something, and or 03 draft, and I'd imagine it's OHL, WHL, OHL, WHL. And there's nothing wrong with that. I'm not saying the league isn't good, but we have reached a point now where good players exist everywhere. And you can look in the, I mean, one of these guys, Dalibor Dvorsky for the Blues, he's Slovakian playing in the second league in Sweden. Like, the second league in Sweden as an 18-year-old is excellent, and that's not saying he's not playing at a good level, but to think that, like, he's not even playing in the top level in Sweden, he's a first rounder, I don't know, it's unreal to me. So I think just on a very micro level with the draft, at least, like, it seems like we're trending in a positive direction there.
Yeah. And I think something that we have talked about, Air, that we can jump into because it connects really well here, but, like, going along with what the Red Wings did and then what you're witnessing now with the more European influence, like, they started that. And absolutely, we've talked about how, like, these coaches that are iffy on guys in Division One, and, like, I'll let you tell that story, but, like, if you're iffy on a guy and you start talking to your buddies, and as soon as one team is like, yeah, we're interested in him, then all of a sudden he gets five offers, where everyone's kind of waiting for permission for one team to go outside the box, and then the floodgates open and everyone's like, okay, this is now within the acceptable range. But the people that change that range are the people that are really driving it forward. And like the Red Wings going over to Europe in the 90s and then continuing that pipeline with the Datsyuks and Zetterberg and continuing to go over there has now made it. And then obviously they've had success, which like leads teams to copycat and do the resulting thing. Just tying a lot of what we've talked about in the last season together, but it encompasses like all of that. and now teams are going over to Europe, and it's becoming more, the scouting staffs are getting bigger over there. There's more of a value placed on it. And then all of a sudden, I think the talent was probably always there, but we were waiting for someone to go dip their toe in and actually make a splash and like really be contrarian and right. And then everyone's like, okay, we can copy that.
Absolutely. Also true, that the Red Wings started that. Like, I think that's, if they don't ever do it or if they don't ever try that and they don't have success with it, no one else is sitting here 20 years later willing to replicate that or willing to, like you said, beef up your European scouting department to figure out if there's other guys like that. I just look back to the 03 draft as we're talking here, and in that draft, four guys of 30 were taken from European leagues. Now, a guy like Thomas Vanek was taken, he's obviously not American, but he was playing college. So there may have been more Europeans. I didn't look that closely, but only four European leagues were represented. So we've increased from 4 to 13 in 20 years, we've increased by threefold. I'm not suggesting that we ever need to get to 100% European, but it's good to see that like we're recognizing more guys exist out there. And to your example or to your like nod there regarding like at the Division I level, what happens. And I obviously I don't work at the Division I level, so I don't necessarily know for a fact that this is what happens, but from my outside perspective, and I would just say less about maybe it's less Division I just in college in general, what you see is like, and I can think of a specific player this year that we were recruiting, who's younger. He's got like 3 years of eligibility till he has to go to college till he's 21. And he was a top player on his team. He was playing on a star-studded team with quite a few guys committed Division I. And we really liked him. Like, I personally really, really liked the way he played. He's super raw. And I can see where if you're coaching at a higher level, like Division I, you might have some hesitations as to like his all around game is not super refined. And at one point he, in the late winter, early springtime, he had two visits to Division I schools, and he let us know like, I'm going to keep playing. I'm not ready to go to school, at least not Division III yet. And that's totally fine. Like, I'd do the same thing if I'm him. And, he didn't end up getting a commitment from either of those schools, to my knowledge anyways. And now he's going to play juniors next year. And I look at him and I still think he could get a Division I opportunity. He's playing in a very good junior league in Canada, and like he's got a shot for sure. But you look at him and then you look at a different guys out there, and I don't have a specific player in mind necessarily, but a guy that has that same set of circumstances where he's looking at Division I and Division III schools, and then he gets on a Division I visit or two, he gets an offer, and as soon as he gets one offer, he gets three. And then now he goes from like, I was debating between going to school at a Division III level or playing juniors and holding out for Division I, and now I'm like, I've got a Division I offer in hand. If I go play your juniors, I can go there. The difference in between those two players is probably almost negligible. It's almost nothing. But one player gets that Division I commitment, which brings in four more Division I offers. And sorry, it gets a Division I offer and it brings in four more. And it's like that. I think when you're trying to identify players at that player identification level, you're looking at like, well, we don't want to swing and miss and be wrong on the kid. But if someone else is swinging, now we can swing and miss too. Now we're willing to swing and miss because we're not the only ones trying to swing here. So it's like Drew Carlson. I'm not sure if I think you can play at the D1 level, but my buddy who plays the D1 or coaches the D1 level, we're talking about you and he thinks you can. I think you can now too. So we're both going to offer you. But if one of us had said no, neither of us would have offered you. Even though probably like I thought all along you could play, and it didn't matter what my buddy said, but it confirmed what I was thinking. And I don't necessarily think it's like, you know, I don't think Ohio State and Michigan are sitting here and going, are you going to offer that kid? Are you going to offer that kid? It's more just like you're talking to other people in hockey, whether it's an NHL scout talks to a USHL GM or USHL GM talks to a Division I assistant. Like, they're all talking, and what one person says probably influences the next guy, which influences the next guy. And the point is, like, the difference sometimes between that kid I mentioned earlier who got two Division I visits but no offers, and the kid who got two Division I visits and then got an offer, and then that trickled in three more offers, like, they're almost the same player a lot of times. And the only difference is one person took a swing, which led to a second, third, and fourth. And one person didn't take a swing, which led to no second, third, or fourth swings.
Yeah, it reminds me of, I'll pull it up quick because I was going to mention it at some point in this episode. I thought it was going to come up. But Naval Ravikant has like a quote that says, if you want to make the wrong decision, ask everyone. And like Jack Butcher built on top of that. And we'll link, at least Jack might be unheard of to some of you guys. We'll link that in the show notes so you can dive down the rabbit hole on him. But Jack built on top of it and said, ask enough people for advice, it'll put you right back where you started. This is not to say that advice is not valuable, only that where it comes from is more valuable than the quantity of it that we receive. The abundance of connectivity in 2023 means that you're only ever a second away from another opinion. It's very difficult to build independent conviction if you form a focus group to review your every decision. So, like, what I take away from that is, if your focus group and the people that you do ask are just from different playing styles, different philosophies of hockey, if you're hearing from an NHL GM that has built an incredible defensive team, like if you're talking and your focus group is the New Jersey Devils GM from the 90s, and you're a coach that doesn't care if he wins every game 10-9, that's not going to be someone that you want in your focus group. So the trick, or the word of caution, I guess, is if you're going to ask people that are philosophically very aligned with you, that believe in the same offensive principles, game models, some version of that, because if you're getting opinions from people that are on the other side of what you believe, just because they're at, again, we've talked about like logo, having the logo, if you're asking someone above you, it's not good enough to just ask an NHL GM if you're in the USHL to be like, hey, what do you think? It has to be an NHL GM that wants to win games 10-9 like you do, for that to like hold water, or at least it should. So like the trap is avoid that, and at least find people that are aligned. But I also think like we have to start building more independent conviction. And I think like a lot of the level one coaches have it, because again, it's like the whole house money thing. Like if you're not supposed to be here and you've got to the levels you've got to doing it your way and it's continuing to work, like who do you really need to ask? And that's going to sound like maybe some of these guys are arrogant or above it, but at the same time, I think we need more people that are pushing the game forward on their own and not trying to like steal from everyone. If you have thoughts on that.
Yeah. Well, first, like, you kind of, the way I think of what you just said, as far as like asking people who are philosophically aligned with you, it's like, ask the right people. Like in all reality, and I think this is totally fine, like fine and true, like what an NHL GM wants to see in an 18-year-old is undoubtedly different than what a Division I coach wants to see in an 18-year-old. They probably want to see a lot of the same habits and tendencies, but like the growth and development pieces are so different. An NHL GM's timeline is the next, call it 3 to 6 years. The Division I coach's timeline is the next 1 to 2 years. And now that's one thing. And then on top of that, like, what kind of game is the college team trying to play versus what kind of game does the NHL team play? Obviously, there's a difference in the level, first of all. So, like, the way the San Jose Sharks play is undoubtedly different than the way the University of Wisconsin plays. But even outside of that, if you are recruiting to Mankato or you are recruiting to BU, it's very different. Obviously, you're going after different players due to demographics and education and all those factors. But you also play a different style of game at BU than you play at Mankato. And I often, and I don't really know the answer to this, but I really wonder, and I don't know the answer because I don't work at a high enough level to have the answer to this, but I do wonder with, like, those NTDP level players and those high-end prospects from the Shattuck St. Mary's and those types of places of the world, like, when you're contemplating where to go to college, and obviously you have a plethora of options. It's not like you're clamoring to find a school that wants you. You know, you've got, just to compare two different ends, two different geographic ends, you've got Minnesota and you've got BU. Like, I'm curious, like, do those guys look at the way BU plays and think, could I fit there? And do they look at the way Minnesota plays and think, do I fit there? Do they look at, like, what is the past? You know, who are some guys that have played for Minnesota in the past? And do I play like them? Yes or no? Who are some guys that have played at BU in the past? Do I play like them or no? Like, for example, if I don't even know who this would be, but if there's a 15-year-old right now who's playing at Shattuck and he has a really similar profile to Jack Eichel, like, okay, I might be a good fit in Hockey East versus Big Ten just because I know Jack had success there. And then on the flip side, like, if I have a really similar profile to, I'm not as familiar with Minnesota, Logan Cooley, then maybe I want to go the Minnesota route because he's had success at a Big Ten school like that. And I don't know, but I sometimes feel, or I guess I wonder, like, is the decision made more on, like, the bells and whistles and the scholarship opportunity and, like, now the NIL money that's involved? Like, is that stuff the biggest factor? Like, I think it's a huge factor, but I wonder how often, and they're young kids, they're 15, 16, 17 years old. So I wouldn't necessarily be surprised if that's getting overlooked at times, but I wonder how often they're considering, like, what's the track record at this place for players like me and what's the style of game this team plays and this conference plays. And would this be a good fit for me? Because I see it at a different level within Division III, but you can watch a junior game or a prep game, and you can theorize pretty well that a player at any of those levels, he might fit in at our conference pretty well, but another conference in Division III plays differently. I don't know how well he'd fit in, or just another team. Like, another team in Division III plays a really run and gun, high offense style, and this guy is much more like slow it down. He doesn't have the best feet. Like, he might not fit in there. And I've seen it within Division III where I watch a kid and I see he commits somewhere and I think to myself, like, I don't see how that's going to work out for him in the next 2 to 3 years. And then sure enough, 2 to 3 years later, he either hasn't played, he's in the portal, whatever. And you're like, I wonder if he had given that more thought at the time, that I need to align how I play with where I'm playing. Or where I'm going. So that's a little bit off topic of what we started out with, but I don't know. It's honestly a genuine question that just came to mind as we were talking about it. Like, do guys really look at that? I don't know.
Yeah, no, I think we can dig in on that because, like, I'm not by any means on the inside. I mean, my network is growing in hockey, but the highest level that I've coached at for people that are just joining us is Tier 3 in the USPHL Premier Division. So, by no means do I know this to be true, but just observing from the outside, and we've talked about this a little bit before, you and I, off air, but, like, I think some of the high level thinkers in our game don't necessarily have the means or understand that like the game's probably not going this way in our country and on our continent, but I think they see the value in like the European academy systems, and they're almost trying to create it here unofficially through like, I call it like an unofficial like pipeline. So like if you were to look at, I've done a lot of study on like the Chicago Steel, and like if you just look at their game sheet every Friday night, like there's a bunch of big block M's from Michigan on the roster over the last like 4 years. And like then you start to think, well, why is that? And then you start to think, well, maybe like it's like what you were alluding to, where whether the kids are, whether the coaches are communicating, whether the system is communicating somehow as a whole, but like if you're a good fit to win 10-9 in Chicago, you also have a coach at Michigan that will play games where he wants to win 10-9. So like if they're teaching the offensive habits and upskilling players offensively in junior on this team, you might be a really good fit to go continue that development, not have that interrupted. You can continue to compound your offensive game and double down, triple down on your strengths. Maybe it's a good fit to play in Chicago for 2 years and Michigan for four. So I think whether they can talk or can do that or not, I have no idea. But it's just something that I observe from the outside that I think teams are maybe starting to kind of create and like funnel or push or suggest guys go in certain directions. If you have any thoughts on that.
Well, just to build like a third level to what you're saying now, and I don't know, it's happened across multiple coaches. Maybe the same GM, if he's been there long enough. I just don't know off the top of my head if he has. But what's now interesting, it's a little bit of me building a narrative because it's happening as we speak, but you've now had Zach Werenski, Ken Johnson, Nick Blankenberg was a free agent signing, Adam Fantilli, and Gavin Brindley, all drafted out of University of Michigan to the Blue Jackets. And as a Blue Jackets fan, I'm partial to that. But I wonder, like, what is there something to that as well now? Where, like, not all those guys played for the Steel. But your kind of thing of, like, you go look at a Steel lineup chart, bunch of block M's. You go look at a Michigan lineup chart over the last few years, quite a few Columbus draft picks. Like, I wonder, is there a correlation there? I mean, I don't know who could have predicted that like Fantilli would definitely go third last night. So like, it's hard to say that there's really a narrative there, but yeah, I think as far as like an unofficial model goes, like you're saying, I mean, it's obviously not like the Chicago Steel don't call themselves the Michigan Junior Wolverines. So it's not like they're a true affiliate. But I think if you are aware of the way Michigan plays and you're aware of the way Steel play, then you can conceivably look at this as a player like Fantilli on the Steel and think like, that's a good spot for me. And he may have been committed before he got to Steel. I don't know, but maybe part of the reason he ended up on the Steel is because he was committed to Michigan too. And I would certainly, I'd be a fan of us getting more academy models, and I think obviously it's a huge thing in European soccer. I just think the benefit to that model is that you get continuity from the time you're, let's say, six to the time you're 21. And imagine if you are, I mean, just take Zach Werenski from Michigan. So Zach Werenski is going to play from the time he's six to the time he's 21 for the Detroit Junior Red Wings. And that's who he's playing for. And then at 21 or whatever, say at 18, he gets drafted. And maybe he doesn't go to the Red Wings in the draft. But from the time he was six to the time he was 18, he got the same coaching and he was brought up in that same system. And obviously there's benefits to be had for NHL teams that get players who were developed like that. But there's a huge benefit to him as well as a player to play in an organization where like you're – year to year, your goals and and your objectives aren't changing. And I think that's when you look at the youth, we're branching off to a little different topic now, but when you look at like the youth system now, I mean, the best example is like, I think sometimes kids get bad raps for like, well, why do you play for Little Caesars and then Honda and then Honey Baked and then Bell Tire? It's like, well, a lot of times he was just going with the same coach every year. So the coach left, so he left. And I don't really blame the kid for that. Like, I think that's good. He's trying to play for the same coach, which is like, now why is the coach not staying in one organization year after year? That's a whole nother question, or a whole nother debate. But like, I think one of the biggest barriers to maybe like the American hockey model becoming as elite as some of the European soccer models are is exactly that. Like, we don't have the best way of developing our players from the time they're six till the time they're ready for the NHL. And I say 18 because that's when you can get drafted, but most guys then play junior hockey and college and or college hockey. And there are a select few, the Austin Matthews of the worlds, that are going to be ready. Connor Bedard's at 18, but a lot of guys are ready come 19, 20, 21. And if they could have, like I said, with Werenski, the Detroit Junior Red Wings, and then he plays for the Detroit Junior Red Wings USHL team, and then he goes to Michigan, there would just be some continuity that right now is lacking. And maybe Adam Fantilli was able to find it because he went from KUA to the Steel to Michigan, now to the Jackets. But like, what about the disruption in Adam Fantilli's life? He lived in remote New Hampshire at KUA, and then he goes to the Chicago, and then he goes to Michigan, and now he's going to Columbus. Like, that's a lot. Like, what if that was all in his backyard, and that was not where he's from in Ontario, but like, I think he's Ontario, right? What if that was all in one place, whether it's Chicago, New Hampshire, whatever, it doesn't matter, but it was all in one place. He developed there all 12 to 15 years of his minor hockey and junior hockey career. I don't know that'll ever happen. But that's sort of, to me, like, it's a missed opportunity right now.
Yeah. And I think by like, just by circumstance, the like high level thinkers in this game are having to do it just any way possible. And this is the next best thing that they can do. So I think it's starting to like trend in that direction, which is nice to see from the outside that there's, again, with the constraints of how our system is set up here, that people are still trying to think about that, where like right now we're essentially developing players on accident and the academy model over there is on purpose. So it's like on accident versus on purpose. And I think anytime you can do something more intentionally, less by just like happenstance, like we're moving to this team because we didn't win enough at 14, then we're moving to this team at 16 because we played a lot and we won, but we didn't really like the part of the country we were in, and then he got drafted in USHL, and then he's going to go to college. So there's all these stops along the way and all this change, and the player essentially develops on accident, where, again, like you articulated with the European soccer model, it's all in-house, on purpose, one age group at a time, plugging holes of each age group to advance to the next one. It's like school. You have to learn A before you can learn B. And they're doing that at the good ones. I mean, obviously, there's probably some bad academies, just like there's bad everything in the world. There's levels to everything. But if you're doing it in a way that I would consider the right way over there, like it's a stepwise progression, and that's why maybe you're starting to see this massive, you know, four kids in 03 are drafted in the first round from Europe, and now we're sitting at half, and like, will that continue to climb? And then if it continues to get over 50 and over 60%, then do we look and be like, we almost have to change now? Like, if that progression keeps up and then it's 70% European in the first round or something like that, like, then I think you might have to, if we're not already looking already, which I think we should be, at our system, like, it's going to be a forcing function at some point when they really start to like beat the pants off of us in terms of first round picks and stuff like that, that you can just tangibly see. I'll kick that over to you.
Absolutely. Like I think of almost everything in just like terms of percentages. So like if right now you called it like we're developing by accident, like, so we're developing one player here and there, two players, you know, maybe more, whatever, but call it 10% with that academy model and that intentional, like deliberate model to develop over the course of many years with the same coaching and the same goals and objectives in mind, you just increase the likelihood that you can develop more players. So you may end up with the same amount of phenoms as US or Canada, but you've produced on an aggregate level way more really good players. And in maybe the model we have now in the US, like you have the extremely, extremely good players like the Bedards and the Fantillis and the McDavids. But then there's this second crop of players that could be, like I mentioned earlier, the Kucherovs and those type of players, but we're missing them right now because they're getting lost in the shuffle. And we're getting a random guy who's able to make it out, call it a Braden Point, like that, but we're not getting consistently over time a bunch of those when maybe we could, because by population and by numbers, the US and Canada should produce more elite hockey players than a country like Sweden or a country like Finland, just because of our population. Again, going back to percentages. So that I think is something worth considering. And then the point you just brought up of like, does that percentage, it's gone from 4 of 30 to now 14 of 32. Does that percentage keep climbing in the years to come? Like to speak outside of hockey terms, it's like if your market share was decreasing over time, year after year after year, and you were losing more and more of your customers to other competitors, you'd be forced to look at your competitors and be like, what are they doing that they're taking so much of the market share from us? And we either need to copy it or differentiate ourselves greatly so that we don't keep doing this. And if you look at this as like a very proprietary thing, which I'm not suggesting that like the draft is, but if you look at the draft as a proprietary thing, like Canada used to own it. The first round used to be almost solely Canadian. And even whatever, 20 years ago, it was almost solely American and Canadian. And now we're looking at like 50% are non-American or Canadian, they're European. So at best, the US and Canada could have 50, but obviously they're going to split that 50 somehow. So your market share has gone down significantly in the last 20 years. Like, to me, that would warrant looking at what they're doing. And I say they as if Europe is just this one entity, but like, look at what the European hockey teams and sports programs are doing and figure out like how is this happening that we've gone from, you know, 26 of 30 Canadian American to now 16 of 30 Canadian American, or I guess 18, I don't know, 18 of 32. I think it would be prudent of, I guess, like if you want to call it USA Hockey or Hockey Canada, or I don't know really who would even look into this. But I think it's worth considering, because like I said, like the fact that you're losing market share in a 20 year time period, significant market share. It's not like it went from 4 to 6 and you just lost a couple, you lost a significant amount. I mean, that European number increased by three times. So yeah, I think long story short, yeah, there should be some research done into what's going on with the European youth hockey world that's allowing these players to come into a market that was entirely dominated by other countries, and now they've taken their own fair share of it.
Yeah. Oh, you're gonna love where I'm about to go. I'm gonna throw out a disclaimer. Mikael Bryan's opinions are not directly affiliated with Drew Carlson's opinions, and Mikael Bryan should still be considered for any job within USA Hockey in the future. But saying all that, like, and the reason I'm going to say you're going to love this is because you just tweeted about, like, and you've brought up to me multiple times that Bill Walsh quote. So you're going to be able to hop in off this in a bunch of different directions. But, like, USA Hockey went over there. I was doing my level four a few years ago, and they had just got back from Finland because Finland was kicking the shit out of us in the World Juniors back 4, 5, 6 years ago. Mm-hmm. And they went over there to steal their drills. And we're talking about a systemic problem. We're talking about, like, this academy model. We're talking about the system that they built, the machine they built, to use, like, a Ryan Hardy term, over there. And we went over to steal drills. Like, what are they doing on the 200 by 85, or I guess over there, 200 by 100? What are they doing over there on the sheet of ice? And what can we steal and take back? And it's like, it's not the drills, man. Like, it's the system. It's the machine that they have over there. It's everything else. And again, you can take the recipe, but we don't know how to cook it. And we're still not cooking it because we only took half the ingredients because we only looked at what they were doing on the ice.
It's like taking the oven, but not putting the same ingredients. And like, well, why can't we make this cake? We got their oven. Well, yeah, but did you put the same ingredients in? Like, I don't mean to suggest that we need to now go run an academy in every city in the US and just be like, we'll solve the problems. It's like, I really think it's like, look at what they're doing and figure out how you can manufacture that here. And to bring it back to Sam Hinkie, like, be contrarian and right. So look at what they're doing. Figure out why it works, first of all. Don't just look at the product, the end product. Like, you need to know the why. You need to know the instructions, the steps 1 through 100 that lead to the end product. And then, like, okay, so just to make it simple, and I don't know the geography of Sweden or Finland well at all, but take a tiny town, not Helsinki or Stockholm. Every single kid in this tiny town that I'm theorizing about plays hockey. And they all, that's all they do outside of school all day long because it's freezing cold all year, whatever. Like, are we going to be able to go force that in Miami, Florida, or Tuscaloosa, Alabama? Like, no, we're not. And I, that would be dumb to try. It's more like, what are some of the principles they're using to develop kids year round? What are some things that they are doing with their coaches to develop their coaches to be able to teach the kids year round? And one of the best, we talked about this, but one of the best quotes I've heard on this, I believe was in Rasmus Ankersen's book, The Goldmine Effect. And he talks about Usain Bolt and how Usain Bolt trains, and who cares what he does now, but he does call it X, Y, and Z things on a daily basis at 20 something years old as a gold medal winner, Olympic gold medalist. And parents want to know what he does, and they find out, and then they take it back to their 10-year-olds, and they have their 10-year-olds do what Usain Bolt's doing. And it's like, hey, I'm going to make my 10-year-old the next Usain Bolt. He's on the Usain Bolt training plan. But what you're missing is that when Usain Bolt was 10 years old, he wasn't doing that. Whatever Usain Bolt was doing at 10, which I don't know what he was doing, and I don't even think Ankersen knows what he was doing, but whatever he was doing at 10, that's what your 10-year-old should be doing, because that's what helped him get to be what he is and who he is today. Not taking this finished product and trying to force it onto a child or a developing teenager. And man, like, it's the same thing that you see, I think, that you see now. And it's not, by no means is it just hockey, but you have so many one sport athletes these days. And look, I wasn't very good at any sport outside of, not even hockey, but definitely not outside of hockey. So I played hockey almost year round, but like, I loved it that much. And I wasn't really that good at anything else, as I got older. But growing up, like, I played baseball, I played soccer, I played basketball, like I played other sports. And it's not that I got this all encompassing leadership lesson from playing basketball in first grade, but you learn, like, you learn translatable skills. You learn spatial awareness in soccer or in basketball because you're in a confined area, just like you are in hockey. And then you get to hockey and you're like, oh, I can use the boards. I have angles now. I didn't have that in soccer. So now I can run this give and go play with myself because I have a board to use. There's these little things that you can pick up from playing other sports, but if all you do is play hockey or all you do is play football all year round, you never learn those other aspects of other sports that you can take to the game that you're playing. And I think, like, you know, I think if you are a kid today or a teenager today and you love hockey so much that all you want to do is be on the ice, I'm never suggesting that you shouldn't do that. But if you enjoy playing other sports and, or you're a parent today and you're considering what to do, what your kids should be doing, like, try all the other sports, play a bunch of different things, because even if you don't like them, you're going to learn something from them and you're going to be able to take whatever you learn into hockey. It's going to make you a better hockey player. It's going to make you a better coach. If you're a coach, like, you know, I enjoy talking to coaches of other sports because they have concepts that I've never heard of and they do things that maybe aren't mainstream or well known in hockey. So yeah, that's kind of my
piece. Yeah, I think where I would like jump off on that and just kind of going back to like, what are they doing that we're not seeing, or what are they doing over there that we weren't looking for? And I actually wrote, I think that one's like behind a paywall, but if it's not, or I'll just drop the paywall and put it in the show notes. But like, I played in college with a kid from Finland that was at like a sport, like his high school was like a sports academy. So he was able to do, people that are familiar with like the TPH model here, that are listening from the States or Canada, he essentially went to school like at a TPH over in Finland, without the name. And he was able to do a skill session a day, a practice a day. He was able to skate on his own before practice. So he was on, or before school, he was on the ice like 3 times a day, twice a day. But then the part that they don't like tell you about, unless you've talked to some of these people or been teammates with them, and like, that's why I have the insight that I have. And that's why I felt so strongly that when they went and stole drills, that they missed 90% of it. But like, when it is warm there, which is like 2 months out of the year, like they're outside playing soccer. And when it's not warm and they're in phys ed class, they're doing way more phys ed and they're able to get that like spatial awareness, and they play a bunch of games and they play a ton of like indoor soccer, like futsal, and they play floorball. And I mean, the floorball is like very, very similar to hockey, but it's still different and the space is more confined, and I think there's even like one less player, maybe, don't quote me on that. But like, they're just getting this, with the like depth of being able to skate 3 times, they're also getting the breadth of playing multiple sports and getting more phys ed and just being better, like building that holistic athlete instead of just building this hockey player that can jump one footed over a Power Edge pro. So yeah. There, or if you want to go further on that, feel free.
No, the only other thing I would add is like, that's, I guess, or not add, but the thing I'd branch off of is like, that's the piece that a lot of times is missing, is that you hear of like, you hear the academy model and you're like, okay, so like in Europe, the kid's pulled from his house at 8 or 9 or 10 years old, and he goes to this academy and he plays soccer all day long. Like, that's what we should do. It's like, hold on. If you go over there and you watch, like, are they literally on the field for 9 hours a day? Like, and that's a real question. I don't know. But I would venture to say, based on exactly the example you just gave, like, no, they're on the field, of course, training for X amount of time. but they are playing other sports and they are learning other things through other activities outside of soccer. And what I find really interesting is, like, most of the guys that I've played or coached with that are European, which for me, just maybe by chance, I guess, has been a lot of Swedes and a lot of Finns. They tend to be really good athletes. Like, they tend to be really good soccer players, good tennis players. Maybe not like American basketball is not their best sport. American football is probably not their best sport either, but they are athletic in the sense that, like, they grew up playing multiple sports and they're good hockey players, but they know that there's more to it than just hockey. And if you go even deeper on this, like, I think there's a reason that Swedes and Finns speak so many languages, because it's the same idea. Like, yeah, you know Swedish, so you can speak to your parents or whatever, and you know Finnish because that's what you need when you go to the grocery store. But a lot of them take a Swede, they're going to know Swedish, Finnish, English, French, Spanish, Italian. Like, I think almost every single Finn or Swede I know knows at least three languages. And to me, it's like, it's how many Americans do you know that know more than English? I mean,
right.
I don't know anything else. Like, so I think that idea, it's just applied to everything in that sort of way of life, where now you're learning other languages, you're playing other sports. And the idea is, like, yeah, maybe knowing how to speak English isn't going to pay dividends now when you're 9 years old, but one day when you want to work in the US, it will. And maybe knowing how to play soccer when you're 12 isn't going to help you as a hockey player, but when you're 18, you're going to be able to pull some lessons that you learn in soccer and apply them to hockey. So that it's holistic. It's not about the drills. It's not about the tactics on the ice. It's about looking at development and player development, coach development from a very holistic perspective, and thinking about what overarching ideas can we use here and make us better that we wouldn't know if we only focused on the one sport all the time.
For sure. We'll wrap there. Probably hit on 5 or 6 topics. Digest that, re-listen to it, hop in the comments. If you want to join the conversation on any of this and share the show with someone else that you might think wants to hear it. And we'll talk to you next time.